Bar Cop Radio.
Drugs and beer in the hot sun. I fought the law and I won. I fought the law and I won. I need a sex and I got mine. I fought the law and I won. I fought the law and I won.
As you know, I am terribly impressed with Susan McDougal. More balls than old Bart's got. If they said, Bart, we're going to put you in jail for 22 months or talk, I'd say Clinton raped me himself. I wouldn't do it. You take away my chinaco, and I start to weep openly. So, no, I ain't going to prison. So I respect her so much. And plus, yeah, all she had to do, she could call Ken Starr anytime, say, all right, I want out. And she didn't do it. She was in Tulsa over the weekend. Went to see her, was damn impressed. I'm not going to play the whole speech. There might be 10 minutes of it here, though. We'll play a little of this and a little of that. First clip I want to play in is the story I teased on the page a day or two ago about Susan being shackled to these two linebacker dudes. She called them enormous men. I'll let her tell the story.
I was scared to death. I'm sitting in the holding cell. It's my first day. And they said, McDougal, step out. And when they did, they handcuffed me, and it was the first time in my life to be handcuffed. And I was prepared for that. They put the belly chain around, and they tied my hands to the belly chain, and that was really scary. I had not prepared for that. Because you know, when you're frightened, how you want at least to be able to put your hands up. And I remember the feeling of, I'm feeling defenseless. And then they put leg chains around my ankles, and I had not for one moment considered that that might happen to me. The tears came in my eyes. I remember a lump in my throat, and I thought, whoa, maybe I am not going to be able to do this. You can only take very small steps. The chain is very short. And as I began to walk, they called two other prisoners out of other cells. Two enormous men came out, and they had been accused of bank robbery, and they were chained to me. We were in a line, and they were chained to me and handcuffed and shackled, and we were led down a long hallway. And I remember thinking all the way down this long hallway with not any windows or doors on either side, and the van at the end of the hallway, thinking, at least my mother will not have to see this. I'll go to jail, I'll get in this van, and this moment of terrible fear and overwhelming indecision will never be made public. The doors opened, and of course, the world was out there. The press was taking pictures. They were shouting questions. It looked like every satellite truck in America was outside those doors, and the lights were bright, and I heard over my shoulder one of those guys say, what the hell did you do? I mean, it had to be like mass murder, right? It could not possibly be that I was there for civil contempt, because it looked like something really bad had happened. And I thought at that moment, you know, I may make it, because that was so funny to me at the moment that they thought I had to be at least a terrorist, you know, to be.
In this next bit, she tears up the lying bush monster. Does a damn good job of it, too.
One of the things I was really glad to hear in the president's inaugural address was the No Child Left Behind bill. I listened to it and I thought to myself, man, I think he may get it. One of the tenets of that bill was that troubled children in our schools, especially children who had parents who were incarcerated, 3 out of 5 of which will end up incarcerated. They will get warm food at school through this program, No Child Left Behind. They will be given after-school care in this program. And I'm going to fund this, and I'm going to make sure that these standards hold, but we're going to help the kids that are most at risk. And do you know when that bill came up for his signature that he vetoed it and did not put one single dime of the money that he promised into that program? And it does not exist after going to every one of the 50 states and talking about it. To me, that is the greatest tragedy of our media. that we hear the splash, we hear the news, we hear what's going on, but we never hear the follow-up because everything is in 30-second spots.
To put this together, I had to, of course, I had the whole speech recorded, then I had to go back and chop it into pieces, and each piece needed a name, just, you know, because it's hard to remember what did part four say, what was part six about. So I entitled this one, Tough to Take.
It makes me think of a girl I met in California. I started a group called How Did We Get Here? We would sit on the concrete floor. We talk about how in the world did girls as smart, because they're young. I was most often in all seven jails the oldest woman in that place. And they are poor. I never met a rich woman in jail. They've already bonded out and they've got lawyers. But this is a graveyard for poor, uneducated women, okay? We're sitting in the floor and they are bright. They are funny. They're the faces that you see on the street every day. And I want to know, how did this happen? How did you get here? And she says, you know, my stepfather started sleeping with me. But I was still going to school. I'd still get up and go to school. And then he started sleeping with my little sister. And I could hear her crying. And I started sneaking out the window at night so I wouldn't have to hear it. And I found a service station down the road, and the door was broken and left open to the bathroom, and I started sleeping in there at night. And I'd eat out of trash cans on the way to school in the morning. I'd just find food, and I'd eat it, and I'd just stay out there. And then some of the boys in the neighborhood found out that I was in there, and I was raped, and I got pregnant, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I started drinking and doping and hooking, and that's how I ended up here. Not mad, not angry. Just that was it. That was the facts, ma'am. I was stunned. I remember the tears coming in my eyes, looking at this young face and wondering why all the other women in that group were not as affected as I was by that story. And when I asked one of the older girls there, she said, Susan, everybody in this place could tell you a story like that one. The Justice Department says 7 out of 10 women who are incarcerated have been brutally sexually or physically abused before they commit their first crime. And we're talking about, if it's before they commit their crime, they are kids. The numbers, the statistics for abused young women are unacceptable in a country as enlightened as we are. It makes me think of Althea, who one day at Conway was rolled into the room. She was a drunk. She'd been drinking on a bench for 2 weeks, and she was in the DTs, and she didn't have consciousness for 2 weeks. In that one room, with all of those women crammed in a room built for 10, sometimes 20, 30, 40 women on a weekend night, crammed into that one windowless, airless room in the hottest part of an Arkansas summer, where the only water that we had to drink, with meals or without, came from the back of a toilet, one of those toilet things that has the fountain on the top of it, that only a man could have devised. No woman would ever make a fountain on the top of a toilet, okay? I'm not believing it. So they roll Althea in over by the telephone, the only phone in the room. And we hate her. She stinks. She's urinated on herself. She's picking off insects that don't exist on her. And for a week and a half, Althea's comatose and dribbling and vomiting and urinating. And we're begging them, please get her out of here. She's just, it's horrible. We have to eat next to this woman. Althea comes to consciousness and sits in our group. How did she get here? She said, you know, I had 5 brothers and sisters, and my dad molested every one of us. He'd come in drunk, and he'd throw our food on the floor, and we ate it like dogs. She said, you know, in my whole life, I never ate off a table. She thought that was funny. She ran away, slept under bridges. She went to shelters, but she was messed with, she said. So she'd hide out. She got to drinking and, you know, doing whatever she could get a drink because it just numbed her mind. She just didn't want to think about it. She didn't want to think about what she had to do next. And Althea ended up in jail. Now think about that money that could have changed the world, that could have taken those children that were once in school and given them somewhere with a hot meal and a little tiny ray of hope. Because I used to think to myself, if that had happened to me, would I have lived? Would I have made it through? Would I have gotten to this point? And I used to tell them, I want you to know one thing. Jail, for all of you, is a victory. It is a point of pride that you made it here alive through what you have been through. And when your resume reads that you made it, I want you to be proud that you did it. But there is no worse shame for the United States than what happens to the mentally ill in jail.
Her whole speech was interesting, but I really liked this next part. I've often told you about a theory I have that Republicans, somehow they don't mean to be such evil bastards. You know, if a Republican senator has an autistic grandchild, you know, he's known to all the charities, but autism, we really ought to do something about that because that's terrible. And if you're a politician who says no to all that wasteful spending, that worthless social program bullshit, but you've got an uncle with Alzheimer's, yeah, he's going to say no to everything but Alzheimer's. You know, it's always everybody else. You know, if I have it or if my family has it, then we're going to fight strongly for it. If you or your family has it, screw you. I'm a Republican. You go screw yourself. I don't care. Well, you know, the same thing works for crime. Remember, we've talked about John Ashcroft's son, I think it was, got caught with felony weight marijuana. And Mr. Hard on Crime, Mr. Tough on the Bad Guys, pulled some strings and got his kid off with a fine and a community service or whatever. If it had been anybody else, they'd go to jail. But since it's Ashcroft's boy, might have been his nephew, who cares, but Ashcroft stepped in and stopped the wheels of justice from doing their job because he knew the guy, he was a good boy. Of course, if it was some nigger that John Ashcroft didn't know, yeah, let's throw the book at him. Son of a bitch, he tried to break our laws. We can't stand for that. We're a nation of laws and rah-rah, wave the flag, bullshit. That's how these Republicans are. They're always out for themselves. If it's my family, we need to take a look at it. If it's your family, go right to hell. So Susan's going to tell you a story about a friend of ours. Oh, also, special bonus. Susan does her Rush Limbaugh impression. You'll like this.
Do you remember Kathleen Willey, the woman who said Clinton groped her? She went on the Chris Matthews show, Hardball, and she said that a young man who was an acquaintance of the Clintons, and she named his name, had come to her and said, I killed your cat, and you're next, if you continue saying these things about Clinton. And Rush Limbaugh picked up the story and started saying it on his radio show. This young man, a friend of the Clintons, has threatened Kathleen Willey's, killed her cat and threatened Kathleen Willey, and this is a horror, and naming this young man who had a wife and two children's name all over national television. Well, this young man had a flight ticket and receipt showing that he was nowhere near where Kathleen Willey lived or worked during the whole time she said this might have happened. He had an airtight alibi. But nonetheless, the media never cared about the facts, especially the Rush Limbaugh media. So there's a man who hears that radio message from Rush Limbaugh, and he goes and hides behind this man's garage, and he lies in wait with a knife. And he is going to kill this man who has threatened this courageous woman coming forth about the groping. And he lies in wait, and he strikes when the man comes out and struggles with him to the ground to kill him, and the young man overpowers him, thank God, and the police come. And that man did not go to jail. That man went to a mental health institute. And his brother, Pat Buchanan, came out to the media and said, you know, my brother is troubled. And isn't it funny that when it's our kid, when it's our brother, when it's our cousin or sister or whatever, it's the justice system isn't working, is it? But the thing that I found more than any other thing is that all of those women that I met were my sister. There wasn't one that I thought with a bit of help would not have changed their life, could not have changed their life with any help at all.
This might be the last clip, but it also might be the best one. You'd almost think Susan had been reading Barkup.com. I know she knows what it is, but I kind of doubt she has time to go surfing and reading Goofy Boy's webpage. But this is very strange, but Susan is going to explain to you why I, Barkup, am worried about Scott Peterson getting a fair trial. She's going to use phrases I've used and my reasons. This is weird, but she's going to explain to you why I'm worried about Scott Peterson getting a fair trial.
Mark Garagus was my lawyer, and he's now the defense lawyer for Scott Peterson, who is probably the most despised man in America. Despite the fact that Mark Garagus believes that this boy is innocent, I have no idea. I've not heard the evidence, and I don't have a clue. But two jurors lied on their juror questionnaire in order to get on the jury and had told friends and family, I'm going to get on there and I'm going to get that guy. Kill that guy. You understand that, don't you? You're going on a jury, a death penalty jury, to kill someone. And you're going on there without hearing a shred of evidence. And in this country, it doesn't matter anymore. We are besieged on every side. We are besieged by war, by famine, by health, by poverty, by unemployment. Our schools are in trouble, and the last thing we care about is a prisoner's right to a fair trial in this country. Because we know, don't we? We know that if they're arrested by the police, they're probably guilty. And that you would lie, and that people would think it was almost okay to want to get on a jury to kill a man, is a shocking thing.
In closing, massive applause. She said something interesting. I don't know if it was a slip or if it was intentional. She said that Mark Garagus believes Scott Peterson is innocent. Now, we don't know if he told her that in the utmost confidence or if he's saying that everywhere. But, you know, a lawyer really can't say that. As soon as you say, I think my client is innocent, and he is innocent, we understand, I mean, hypothetically. Okay, then the next time you represent a guilty guy, and they say, well, is this guy innocent too? And if you say no comment, well, that means he did it. That means he's guilty as hell. A criminal lawyer can never say, my client is innocent in that context, because, you know, he's trapped for the next time. So I thought that was interesting. I also thought it was striking that she and I thought along the same lines about, I don't have any more idea than you or Susan McDougal about whether or not Scott Peterson did it. But all I ever wanted was for Scott Peterson was a fair trial. At least look at the evidence before you put the man to death.